Me.
Focus Features presents Back to Black.
I want people to hear my voice and just forget their troubles.
Experience the music and her story.
Know this,
I ain't no Spice Girl.
Like never before.
That's my daughter, that's my Amy.
On the big screen.
I want to be remembered for just being me.
Amy Winehouse, Back to Black, directed by Sam Taylor Johnson. Rated R, under 17, not a minute without parent. Only in theaters May 17th.
You know you've got a comeback in you. When you take the next step, you're going to make it count. For your career, for your family, for your life. You can earn a degree you're proud of with Purdue Global. Purdue Global is backed by Purdue University, one of the nation's most respected and innovative public universities. This is your chance. This is your opportunity. This is your comeback. Purdue Global, Purdue's online university for working adults. Start your comeback today at purdueglobal.edu.
When you buy Kroger brand products, you feel like you're winning. That's because they offer proven quality at lower than low prices. In fact, we guarantee that you and your family will love how Kroger brand products taste, or you get your money back. So next time you're shopping for the family, look for delicious Kroger brand products, because they'll make you all feel like you're winning. Shop now, in-store, or online. Kroger, fresh for everyone.
Hey, everybody, it's me, Rosie O'Donnell, and happy Halloween! Happy Halloween. I can't resist the candy corn. When I go to CVS to get my medicine, there's candy corn always around this time. And, you know, I'm not even a real fan of candy corn, but I like having it out in a dish in my house. It makes it feel like it's Halloween. And you know, when I was much younger, my first go-round as a mom with my four little ones, who are now 21 to 28, so they're all big kids, but we used to have the greatest display in our yard. Like, we bought everything that you could buy in terms of blow-up, lit-up, moving things, you know, and we used to have beer for the adults and water and juice for the kids and haystacks to sit on. And it was so amazing. Well, my kiddo, Dakota, who is now going by Clay, but wants me to call them Dakota. So I know it's confusing, but just so we know, there's only one kid and they are going to be 11 in January. Well, they had their first Halloween party on the weekend. And it was thrilling, I have to say, to see them so excited. It was just a couple kids because big crowds don't do so well with their nervous system. And so we had a small group, but fun was had by all, I could tell you that. And I'm happy to have the distraction of Halloween. Quite honestly, it's kind of hard to talk about what's going on in the world. And I haven't really been doing TikToks. It's a troubling time for so many, PTSD and people who, like me, have very thin membranes in the world. Like, things seem to permeate inside me in a manner that is debilitating to me. So I feel completely debilitated by what's going on in the Mideast. I feel debilitated by the white male American terrorist who shot up two towns in Maine, a bowling alley and a billiards place, killing so many. The Speaker of the House, who's a Trumper. The problem with having a Trumper is that you end up with someone like Netanyahu running your country, and that doesn't serve its people. So I don't know what to say. We did this interview a couple days ago with my really good friend, Charles Bush, who is so wonderful. He is just amazing. He's written a memoir, and he's brought so many people, so much entertainment. He's, how do you explain Charles, you know? Charles is an author of an laugh-out-loud memoir called Leading Lady, A Memoir of a Most Unusual Boy. and the title does not lie. Charles grew up the movie and the play Mame, the musical Mame, you know. He had an auntie Mame, and her name was Lil, and she went on to adopt him after his mom died when he was quite young. And he became a theater writer, award-winning, playwright, a theater actress, drag legend, way before anyone, including Charles, thought that drag would become legendary and as popular as it is today in our culture. Leading Lady, it's a wonderful book. It's filled with big names, and Charles drops them eloquently, including mine. There's a chapter on our time with Boy George, creating that monster show called Taboo. And it was the best of times. It was the worst of times, but I have zero regrets. I really think everything in your life takes you to where you are in this moment, and living in the present is the only way to do it. So we're going to give you, 50 minutes of a very entertaining, intelligent, kind, loving artist named Charles Bush. Sit back and enjoy a conversation with Charles Bush. Well, hello, Charles Bush. It's lovely to see you, even though it's only virtually.
It's better than nothing.
You're damn right. It's better than nothing. How are you?
I'm doing very well, very well. And I'm just so looking forward to chatting with you. It's been so long. And of course, here I've written this book, and there's a big chapter about you. I hope you approve.
I approve. I read it. I was like, that was a crazy time. Whatever anybody's experience was, I'm going to validate, because it was not a great time for me. Wow. You know, getting sued and leaving my show and not really figuring out what was happening there on the set of Taboo.
You were just criticized right and left. You just couldn't win.
Exactly. Couldn't win. But you know what? I'm proud of that show. I think you did a great job. I think that George wasn't in the best shape right then in his life as a person who struggles with addiction. And, I think we had a lot of things against us. But you know that Stephen Sondheim said before he died, he thought it was one of the most underrated musicals of his lifetime.
Oh, yeah. I was so, I don't know about you, but I find particularly when something's so kind of fresh disaster, I can't really see anything good about it. But
afterwards,
Tony Kushner and Susan Stroman would tell me how much they love Taboo. And I thought, well, they're pretty smart people. I better, reevaluate it.
Yeah. I mean, without a doubt, you can't, in the midst of the tragedy, It feels so overwhelming, and you think you'll never, ever get through it and survive it. And I loved doing it. I loved getting to be a part of it. I didn't fully understand what I was getting into, but I'm thankful to this day that you said yes to me, and I'm sorry we didn't go on the Concorde.
That's how you were seducing me. But even still.
I loved when you wrote that. I thought, maybe I was. I definitely wanted you to do it. When I saw it, I thought, there's no book here. There's no real story. And who would get the humor and the pathos and the pathos, I guess that's the word. Yeah. I thought of you because, I know I've told you this, Charles, in person, but Tale of the Allergist Wife was the funniest thing that I ever saw in a theater in my life. I could not believe. Now, I have to remind you, I knew nothing about it when I went in. Uh-huh. I just knew it was Linda Lavin. And I went in and I was completely blown away. And then I was in my Charles Bush wormhole and I've never left. You're an incredibly talented guy. And I'm so happy that our paths crossed and that you were generous enough to try to do this impossible thing with me.
At first, I thought it was kind of a nutty idea. And then, after we spent some time together, first of all, I was touched by the, it's so rare that somebody goes into a project like you did with this with such a pure motive, that you really wanted to do something artistic with people that you respect. And it annoyed me that after it was over that you weren't given credit for that. So anyway,
it was a very bad time. I think that when somebody makes a big move like, you know, to leave that show was hard for some people. People were mad, you know? And then I got sued by the magazine. And it was like a year of bad press, maybe even two. And it was just icky. But I have fond memories of it. You know, I put on the soundtrack, the cast album sometimes. Yes. And I love remembering the auditions. I loved remembering, like, to tell Brooke to go get a little punked out before she came back and belted it. You know, like, I felt like, oh, my God, this is Judy and Mickey and I'm doing it. You know?
Yeah, but I do remember, though, one kind of outrageous thing, though, with you, that when we were having auditions for the part of Big Sue.
Yes.
And we're all sitting there behind the table, you know, the tribunal, and Liz McCartney walked in, and she was fantastic. And before anyone else could say anything, you said, "Hey, welcome to Broadway, your Broadway show."
Exactly. Well, I didn't even know you had to talk to the other people.
I know. I whispered to the director. I said, "Do we just cast the lead of the show?" He said, "Yeah, okay." But thank God, she was great. I mean, she was the best one who auditioned.
And that part meant so much to me, that role, you know, of kind of the fat friend with the gay guy and wanting to be a part of something, but not knowing how to fit in. And I just felt like that was that spoke to me, that part. And and we had such trouble in the auditions. I'm like, where's the person who's going to knock this song out of the out of the park? And she sure did, didn't she?
Yes, and she was pregnant. Didn't she stay in the show?
Yes.
Wasn't she about 9 months pregnant?
Yeah, she was 9 months when we opened or something like that.
Yeah.
But fond memories. I loved your book, and I can't believe that it took you 12 years to write it, although you were writing plays in between.
Yeah. I had about four plays in between, so I took a break. And I just didn't know really what form it was going to be, and I would go to the bookstores and look up, Lena Dunham, how'd she do her book? Oh, it's all short stories. Oh, maybe it should be that. And then I'd look at somebody else's book and, oh, it starts in chapter one, I Am Born. Oh, maybe it ought to be that one.
But right.
It ended up, after all those years, being exactly where I started out. And I'm very happy with it. It's got a strange structure. It's mostly chronological, but then I go off on detours, as we would if we're telling our story, you know, to friends in our
living room.
So it's something like, I always, a good example, I guess, would be that, you know, I grew up in New York City, and my Aunt Lillian, who's really the leading lady of the title, leading lady.
Yes.
Started taking me to Broadway shows when I was about eight. And so in the book, I'll say that one of the shows we saw was Hello, Dolly! With Carol Channing, which then reminds me of when I shared a dressing room with her at a fundraiser 40 years later.
So, tell everyone that story, please.
This is kind of what happens to me. I've had this career as a male actress, and maybe it's, I don't know what to call myself, but I'm an actress.
But that's perfect, a male actress. You've won awards for your acting, and you play a grand dame like no one else does, Charles. It's almost like you're channeling something.
Yeah, well, that's a really good way of putting it. It just kind of comes out of me. But consequently, often I end up being put in the women's dressing room, and nobody seems to blink. No woman has ever said, "Excuse me, why are you in here?" No, I'm just kind of accepted as one of them. So one time it was, I think maybe one of the Equity Fights AIDS things, like Gypsy of the Year or something like that, or Easter Bonnet competition. And so my friend Carl and I arrived, and we were sent up to this big communal dressing room and at the New Amsterdam Theater. And then Mario Cantone is a friend of all of us.
Yes, wonderful guy.
And said, "Do you know you're in the women's dressing room?" I said, "No, I'm not." And he goes, "Yeah, look, you know, I'm downstairs with Brian Stokes Mitchell and Patrick Stewart, and you're here with Betty Buckley and Audra McDonald." And also at that point, Carol Channing walks in with her husband, Charles Lowe, and they say hello to us. And then she sits down next to me at the dressing table, and we're putting on our makeup, and she's doing this, you know, wild, stylized, you know, old time Broadway makeup.
Right.
And we're all just, you know, fascinated seeing Carol Channing putting on her face. And I'm putting on my false eyelashes, and she says, "Oh, I can't wear false eyelashes anymore because I have a permanent eye infection." But so then she starts taking a black eyebrow pencil, just drawing stripes. Black stripes on her eyelids. And I'm thinking, I don't think this is going to work, you know, but we're just rapt, fascinated watching her. And when she finally finished, she just turned and her face was maybe 3 inches to mine. And she said, "How do I look?" And I pulled back a bit and I said, "You look like her." And that's exactly what you needed to hear. No, because that's right. What we all want is just, yes, can I still turn the trick? Can I still be who I was? And she did. And then she got it. That was what she needed to hear. She got up and she could now just hang out with Carol Burnett.
So wild. She once came into the dressing room of Grease when I was there, and Bobby Pierce was my dresser.
No.
And he's a wonderfully talented Tony nominated costume designer. He's a big guy. We look alike, kind of. We similar, right, features. And so I was in the shower when Carol Channing came in to say hello, and Bobby was there talking and saying yes, and I walked out and I said, "Oh, Carol Channing," and she said, "Hello, darling. Wasn't Rosie wonderful?" And pointed to Bobby. And I didn't know what to do, so I just went with it, you know. The thing in your book that I loved is, of course, your anti-mame life. You really do have lived a life of anti-mame. Yeah. And I've always thought of it like that when you've told me stories about your aunt. And yeah, it's, and in the book, you get to see some of the twists and the dark things. Like, I was shocked to find out that your aunt pitted you against your dad.
Yeah, well, you know, think of it with our parents.
Your mom died when you were 10.
Yeah, when I was 7, yeah.
And, 7, yes.
And the thing is, I don't think you necessarily have to forgive a parent everything, but I think if you can try to understand and put in context the mistakes they made. And I have to say, my aunt really, you know, there's basically, she made every right choice for me. I mean, I owe her everything. But, you know, she was human. And I thought it was important in the book not just to paint a completely idealized portrait of her. I don't think she really would have appreciated that. You know, she was such an honest person. So I thought, you know, the couple things that she, you know, did wrong, but out of her own emotions, you know, she really just hated my father. And she had pretty good reason, actually, for being disturbed by his irresponsibility. And at one point,
but you felt torn between.
Yeah, but it was, you know, yes. I don't think you should ever really try to alienate someone from another person. And
right,
she just couldn't help it at a certain point. She tried. She really tried for the first years after my mother died. You know, even though my father was so irresponsible, she thought it was important that I had this strong male figure. So she defended him and all that. And at a certain point, she just couldn't take it anymore. She just couldn't take it. So suddenly she just dropped this illusion and turned my father into this Dickensian kind of villain. And it was kind of hard because he was so much fun, you know.
Right.
You know, and he never hit us. He was never drunk. He was, you know, my father was absolutely just basically 17 years old and never, you know,
never grew up.
And fun, affectionate, loved old movies. But he was, you know, really just so careless and irresponsible. And I finally, you know, I was so connected with my aunt who, you know, was at this point had, you know, adopted me. So I just felt I basically had to choose. And that was very hurtful. But fortunately, at the end of my father's life, I was able to somehow try to heal myself of this coldness and feel some kind of affection for him. And, you know, and he just was so completely uncritical. He accepted whatever you threw at him.
Right, right.
So I had at the end, you know, in the last few years. You know, it was
that's important, I think.
After my aunt had died, I was able to somehow visit my father in Florida and, you know, just embrace him. And it was good for both of us.
Yeah, I think that when you don't have that, which I didn't get with my dad, I think it always leaves you somewhat longing, you know,
I'm sure,
before he passed. But, you know, choices we make and where we find ourselves, you never would expect when you were a child. I was very surprised to find out that as much as she embraced your feminine side,
yeah,
she was a little flipped out that you were gay.
Yeah, that was a surprise because she was just a real, you know, classic liberal Democrat, you know.
Yeah. But,
I have to kind of give her a little bit of slack in that it was 1973. Mm-hmm. And, you know, gay imagery was still pretty horrible in the media. And
right.
And as much as she was a sophisticated New Yorker, she really didn't have gay friends. It's a pity. You know, she would have had a much less lonely old age.
Right.
You know, if she just had had a group of, you know, gay guys who thought she was fabulous, it would have been very helpful to her. But it was when she kind of confronted me in college, it was sort of obvious what was going on. She said, so are you gay? And I said, yeah. And she flipped out. She just, you know, sobbed and was so misinformed. And, you know, but I think in a way, sex to her was not a big deal. Like she, you know,
right.
Her husband died. You know, she never went on a date or anything, or, you know, so I think that what she couldn't quite get was like, why would, you know, in 1973, why would you want to be, you know, gay when
right.
this, you know, you're completely shunned by society.
Yes.
You know, just because you're going to go through all that just for sex.
Right. Right. Yeah.
It seems so.
That's a lot of work, a lot to give up, but it's not just the sex as we know.
She just didn't understand. She's
yeah. Yeah.
But, you know, later, of course, you know, whenever I would bring boyfriends home to meet her or whatever, she was, couldn't have been nicer to them and lent one money when he was in trouble.
Really?
We just never discussed the romantic or sexual aspect of the relationship.
Yeah, that's so funny. It's so different. Can you imagine that we have lived this long, that we have seen such a change in the way homosexuality is presented in mainstream media and in the culture now, which it was just devoid. Yeah. I keep telling people, like, there were no role models. What I remember first is Billie Jean King denying that she was gay and Martina denying, because I was looking for gay role models and I thought I saw them in those women.
Right.
But then, you know, at 10, when I was watching TV in 73, there they were saying that. Now, they had to at the time. Uh-huh. It was terrifying, right? Yeah. Nobody knew what to do or how to come out.
And in movies, you know, or television, there were no role models in, you know, or anyone you could watch in a movie that wasn't just like a villain or a killer, you know?
Right?
Yeah, or a terrible victim. And that's, of course, what my aunt was watching and just thinking, oh, I don't want that for my kid.
Of course. Yeah. Now, I know that you had two sisters, right?
Mm-hmm.
And you were very close to your older one.
Well, both my sisters were older. I have sisters. Was 2.5 years older than I have a sister who's 10 years older who it's I don't have a close relationship with, but I was extraordinarily close with my middle sister who just passed away in July. And
yeah, I was going to say that must have been horrible.
It's very difficult. I don't know. I don't think I'll ever get over this one.
Yeah.
We were so almost like empaths with each other. Mm. Really could feel what the other one was feeling from long distances. I mean, it was, you know, I'm not that kind of woo-woo person, but
right.
So many instances where, you know, where I would be walking down the street and suddenly feel this kind of clutch in my heart. And then later I'd find out that my sister had fainted.
Oh.
Yeah. It's
wow.
And we never, you know, when we became the same age, basically, when I was 16 and she was 19, you know, we used to fight as kids, you know, but we became the same age at 16 and 19. And at that point, we never had a single moment of tension between us. It's odd. I mean, you know, yeah.
It's almost like you were twins.
Like twins, just not a moment of disagreement, just total, just trying to protect each other, just love and protection. Yeah. So I don't know. It's just very difficult. I just don't know how to get quite over this. Time goes by and, you know, but at the moment it's still very fresh. And about five times a day I reach for the phone, like, oh, I got to tell her everything. Oh, I got, I mean, I'm sure in an hour I'm going to say, oh, I got to tell her about what Rosie just said, you know?
Right, right.
Yeah,
but I understand.
An afternoon with her at one time.
Yes, I remember.
She's so cute.
Yeah. Adorable. And you guys, you know, really had that Tweedledee and Tweedledum kind of finishing each other's sentences.
Well, yes, and we spent so much time growing up in the bathroom mirror, you know, doing faces and impersonations for each other. And, you know, my Betty Davis wasn't nearly as good as her James Cagney.
Your aunt as well has passed away. And that I read in the book that I didn't know that you were very close with Joan Rivers, that you used her as a surrogate mother, kind of.
Well, yes. I mean, I hope I don't give the impression that, you know, I was like the closest thing in her
no,
life.
No, no, no.
I was kind of, I always think I was sort of second tier friend of hers.
That's okay.
Yeah, but second tier is pretty good. You know? And sat next to her every year at Thanksgiving. Yeah. You know?
Right.
I just adored her. But I get, you know, throughout my life, I wonder if this is happens with you, because, you know, since we bonded over the fact that we lost our mother so early.
Yes, exactly.
I just get these big crushes on certain kind of lady who's...
So do I.
And maternal and smart. And I just get big crushes. And Joan was kind of number one. And, you know, with her, I think most of her friends would say that you felt so safe that if anything should ever happen to you, you know, she'd step in and fix it. Yeah.
I didn't have her on my show. I think I had her on once.
Uh-huh.
But we got to know each other at the end by going, you know, to theater when I was sort of done with my show and just in New York. And so I would see her at every opening and every art gallery thing. And so then we started talking and she'd usually be with Cindy Adams, who would do nothing but make fun of my outfit the entire evening. So it was a lot of stress, you know. She's like, well, you couldn't find your gardening clothes? I'm like, okay, all right, that's a good one.
Yeah, it's kind of like that in my book. I'd tell about how we went to the the LGBT sort of synagogue. It was at the Javits Center, basically. This Kol Nidre service. And and so I went with her, and she's standing up for the entire thing. And I said afterwards, I said, it was very touching when that old lesbian, the gray hair, you know, joined the men and carried the Torah down the aisle. I was very moved by that. And Joan said it'd be more moving if she'd washed her hair.
Well, you know, there are people, Kathy's like that. Kathy Griffin has these wonderful salons, like the old time, you know, dames getting together in Hollywood. And she insists that you wear a dress and makeup.
What do you do?
You know? I did. I wore like some version of a dress, but it was a dress. I had tights, but it was a dress. And I went, you know, with lipstick. That was it. But
my gosh,
she said that I was banned for two of them for my dress in the one before. So, you know, you got to really watch it with some of these girls. They really like the whole look to be right.
That reminds me of my friend Kathy, who basically has custody of me. You know, she's done my wigs for my whole career, and she lives around the corner, and so she just takes care of me. And anyway, she's gay and doesn't, you know, just always in pants and everything. And so we were gonna, I think it was for some event. It might have been my book party or something. And I said, so what are you gonna wear? You know, and she's like, I can't wear a dress. The only time I've wore a dress was when I borrowed yours. that was true. That was true.
More with Charles right after this.
Presents Back to Black.
I want people to hear my voice and just forget their troubles.
Experience the music and her story.
Know this, I ain't no Spice Girl.
Like never before.
That's my daughter, that's my Amy.
On the big screen.
I want to be remembered for just being me.
Amy Winehouse, Back to Black, directed by Sam Taylor Johnson. Rated R, under 17, not a minute without parent. Only in theaters May 17th.
This is it. Your moment. This is your time to make your comeback with Purdue Global. When you come back with a Purdue Global degree, you create opportunity for yourself, your family, and your future. It's a degree you can be proud of, a degree that employers will trust and respect. Purdue Global offers working adults like you over 175 flexible degree programs to meet your specific career goals. These include associate, bachelor's, master's, and doctoral degrees and certificates. Purdue Global degree programs range from nursing to business to communication and more. Whatever your interest, we have the degree that will move you forward.
You have the knowledge. You have the experience. Now it's time to get credit for the work you've done and earn the recognition you deserve with Purdue Global, Purdue's online university for working adults. You know you're worth it. We do too. So don't wait another second to get the degree that will take your career to the next level. Start your comeback today at purdueglobal.edu.
Hey guys, you know what this playground could use? A wine country, huh?
A redwood forest would be cool.
Ski slopes!
Wait!
Did we just invent California?
Discover why California is the ultimate playground at visitcalifornia.com.
Now, talking about similarities between you and I, we both had a heart attack. And you ignored it just like I did.
Did you ignore it? Yeah.
I ignored it.
I thought I threw my back out.
Mm. Yeah.
Went to the chiropractor.
Right.
Yeah.
At least you went somewhere. I stayed home for 3 days going, my arms really hurt. And everyone going, you look so pale. And me falling asleep and sweating. And every single sign you could Google, I had. But I went back to sleep. And, you know, the doctor said you were like 10 minutes away from being dead. What did you do? Tell everybody what you did when you thought it was a chiropractic injury.
Yeah, I thought, oh, I pulled my back out. And went to the chiropractor who cracked me in three places. And I told him, this guy, I said, oh, I have this weird pain down my arm. And
yeah, right.
He just, I'm going to crack you. You know, and then months went by and I started losing all this weight. And I had the good days and not so good days. And finally, you know, I always assume I have cancer.
Right, me too.
If I stub my toe, it's cancer. You know,
me too, me too.
Anyway, I finally called my friend the allergist, who Barry Cohn, who my play is inspired by, and whatever I told him, he said, hold, I'm putting on hold. He called a gastroenterologist at Weill Cornell, who then said he'd see me right away, and I went there, and this young gastroenterologist said, you know, so let me just listen to your heart. And he had this weird look on his face.
Yeah, yeah.
He said, you know, he said, I think you need to go to the fourth floor, the fourth.
Right away.
Cardiology to have an EKG and an echo or whatever. And so I went down to the fourth floor and the waiting room was filled up with people. And now I had just been nominated for a Tony Award, you know, so I thought, you know, they rushed me through. I thought it was because I'm a celebrity, you know.
Of course, you're well known, death. Well known.
Yeah, they thought I was near death. And,
right.
And they give me they do this echo on me, and the room starts filling up with people. And I thought, oh, God, I am in trouble. And indeed, I'd had an aortic aneurysm, which would kill Jonathan Larson and John Ritter, you know, within an hour. But I, you know, ran around for 3 months.
Doing this.
And so then, they, you know, the doctors said to, you know, took me in her little room and said, you can't go home. You have to have open heart surgery within the next 48 hours and you can't go home. The surgeon was right there, you know, in the scrubs. And I guess he thought I might get the hell out of there. And he said, Mr. Bush, what you've had kills most people within the hour. You were lucky once. You will not be lucky again. And so I'm with you. I'm coming.
Go ahead. Scrub me in.
Yeah, I'm ready to go, ready to go. And that was, I have to say that that was in 2001, and it really did divide my life in half. And in a certain sense, you know, the feelings I had as a child that were, you know, being kind of fragile, all of a sudden kind of came back in a way. I don't know if I've ever really been quite, had the same arrogance of, oh, my body, you know, nothing's going to happen to me.
Exactly.
I had another surgery last December. Yeah.
Another heart one.
Yeah. I had to have this time. The aortic valve is gorgeous, but the but now the mitral valve is a problem, and it wasn't nearly as dramatic, you know. But I had, you know, they cracked me open, and it was, and I said to the, when I met with the surgeon, it was the head of my old doctor, old surgeon, Dr. Girardi, is now the head of the whole, you know, cardiac, you know, surgery thing at Weill Cornell. And I said, now, Dr. Girardi, I said, you know, in my world of showbiz, it's always best when the director of the original picture directs the sequel. he said, I will do the next surgery. And then it was kind of, I thought it was a little weird. So I go in the hospital, and then, you know, after I get out of, you know, surgery and I wake up, you know, the doctors all come in the room, and Dr. Girardi said, it all went well. We were able to, We're able to replace, we're able to repair the mitral valve, not replace it. And then he said, you know, and while I was in there, I have to tell you, my work from 2001 really held up. I mean, it really looks great. And I'm so happy for you.
Yeah, exactly. And for me. But now, do you spend a lot of time thinking, why did I survive that?
No.
I do. I spend a lot
really?
Of time.
Really? What do you, is it a guilt feeling?
It was 3 days instead of 3 months for me. But, you know, when I got there, like, the doctor was like, why didn't you come in? You had, the pain must have been unbelievable. How did you not, you know? And I really thought about it. And I thought, you know, it's so weird, Charles. What was going through my head is, what if the ambulance really needs to go to an accident? And I'm just, you know, having a panic attack. What if, like, I kept thinking I wasn't deserving of going to get checked? Isn't that weird?
That's very weird. Oh, Rosie.
But then as I did in a research about women's heart attacks afterwards, I found it's a commonplace that women are so kind of subjugated that, you know, men have a pain in their chest. They're in the ER before they, you know, finish their coffee, right? Women have a pain in their chest. They call their friend. I called Linda Richmond. And I said to her, here are my symptoms. Do you think I'm having a heart attack? I went to therapy, said to my therapist, do you think I'm having a heart attack? And I slept 2 nights with full heart attack, with 100% blockage of my LAD. And what they told me in the hospital, Martin Luther King's eldest daughter had the same one that I had, the Widowmaker, and she was dead before she hit the ground. And they kept saying that to me. And I was like, How did I do it? And was my mom involved? And don't know. Like I have magical thinking still when it comes to death.
Yes. No, I had a kind of moment, interesting moment when, in the first time in 2001 where, because when I got back from the hospital after a week, I was home and I was watching TV and I had this weird episode where suddenly I had complete amnesia of what had happened. And I was home a week and I looked down my chest, I saw these bandages and I said, what the hell is this? I started pulling them off and my friend Carl was there and he said, you had heart surgery, a week ago or a couple of weeks ago. And anyway, after about an hour, it all came back to me, but I went back into the hospital and I think it turned out it was like some little bit of anesthesia, something that flips through your brain or something. But anyway, when I was in the hospital again to check, see if I had a stroke or something, they put me in this kind of MRI machine. And I really did have this very Spielbergian moment all of a sudden it's very out of character for me, but I did feel like the ghosts, some of the spirits of my mother and my aunts were kind of floating above. And I kind of I was so depressed. I was just in such a low. I said, I just surrender. And I did feel this incredible feeling of love. And I'm just not that kind of, I'm really not that kind of person, but I did feel this extraordinary moment. Yeah.
Yeah. What do you think happens after we die? You think we linger? Do you think our spirits are accessible to earthlings still? What do you think?
I'd love to feel all this thing. I was raised with no religion at all. Mm. Absolutely. And, I generally think nothing happens, but I sure like to believe it.
Me too. I'd like to believe it. Sometimes I do. Sometimes I get carried away in the magical, mystical. I love the part in the book where you talked about AIDS and the people you lost and what it was like living through that. It must have been very hard, that part.
Yes. So it really, for my generation, it's a bit of our World War II.
Mm-hmm.
And we kind of talk about it, I think, to younger people about, those days. And it was an odd period because in a certain sense, my career had finally taken off and it was like the best of times, the worst of times.
Mm.
Yeah. And then in our, I had my own theater company for 7 years and, and we had three of our, our family died so terribly. And, we just, the memorial service really was our art form.
Mm.
Yeah. We gave
completely.
Yeah.
And all, you know, the lesbians taking care of their sick brothers. Like Lori always talks about making that movie, you know, like where the lesbians were right on the front line with everyone, you know?
Yes, and, yes, it's so true, because so often gay men and gay women have so little to do with each other. Mm. And
in the olden days, like when we were kids.
Yeah.
But
yeah.
Nowadays it's all gender queer fluid, right? Everybody's together.
Yeah. Yeah, back in the day, it really was so separated, and both sides were rather critical of each other.
Exactly. I remember that vividly.
The crisis when there are so many instances of gay women coming. Well, I'm getting very choked up talking about it.
Yeah.
Just gay women coming in, stepping up, and
yes.
really being in the forefront of caring for these gay men.
Yeah, that's a story I'd love to be a part of telling. Well, Charles, you're delightful. I love you very much. I always have. You're one of the best playwrights around. You're an amazing actor. You're a wonderful person and performer and friend. And I just want to thank you for being in my life and for saying yes to my crazy desire to produce Tepu. And, you know, your book, Leading Lady, everyone go get it. Charles Bush. And you'll love it. It's a wonderful... wonderful story of a very full and interesting life of an artist, and you certainly are.
Well, thank you, Ro. It's so good to see you, and we have wonderful memories together. I've mellowed, and I can really enjoy. I can appreciate Tabu, and I can also just think about that extraordinary cast of young people.
Yes, there were wonderful moments, and you know. It was chaos, though. Make no mistake.
We survived.
We survived, damn it. Well, I love you. Take care of yourself. Give my love to everybody in your mishpucha.
I sure will. Bye-bye.
All right, honey. Take care. We'll be back with questions from you, the lovely listeners, so don't go away.
Presents Back to Black.
I want people to hear my voice and just forget their troubles.
Experience the music and her story.
Know this,
I ain't no Spice Girl.
Like never before.
That's my daughter, that's my Amy.
On the big screen.
I want to be remembered for just being me.
Amy Winehouse, Back to Black, directed by Sam Taylor Johnson. Rated R, under 17, not a minute without parent. Only in theaters May 17th.
This is it. Your moment. This is your time to make your comeback with Purdue Global. When you come back with a Purdue Global degree, you create opportunity for yourself, your family, and your future. It's a degree you can be proud of, a degree that employers will trust and respect. Purdue Global offers working adults like you over 175 flexible degree programs to meet your specific career goals. These include associate, bachelor's, master's, and doctoral degrees and certificates. Purdue Global degree programs range from nursing to business to communication and more. Whatever your interest, we have the degree that will move you forward. You have the knowledge. You have the experience. Now it's time to get credit for the work you've done and earn the recognition you deserve with Purdue Global, Purdue's online university for working adults. You know you're worth it. We do too. So don't wait another second to get the degree that will take your career to the next level. Start your comeback today at purdueglobal.edu.
Hey guys, you know what this playground could use? A wine country, huh?
A redwood forest would be cool.
Ski slopes!
Wait! Did we just invent California?
Discover why California is the ultimate playground at visitcalifornia.com.
Charles Bush is really a unique individual, and I love him so much. I hope you enjoyed that. Now, let's hear from you, the listeners. I hear we got someone from Long Island. Hit it.
Hi, Rosie. This is Jennifer from Long Island, New York. I always felt like I connected with you because we're both from the same area of Long Island. Anyway, I really enjoyed watching your show in the 90s, even though I was in college and grad school at the time, and I didn't have a lot of time to watch TV. I always made sure I taped your show. I'm aging myself there. But I always made sure I taped your show, especially when there was a guest that I really liked or someone from daytime TV or a Broadway performance. I loved watching your show then. And I'm really enjoying reconnecting with you on your podcast with your authenticity. Anyway, I had a question about the guide dog experience that you've been having. I wanted to know more about that. I have physical issues myself, so I always think about getting a guide dog in the future. Right now, I have a little cat that I don't think would appreciate that very much. But my dentist actually has a therapy dog in the dentist office, which is the greatest thing ever. And I just always thought about getting my own guide dog or therapy dog in the future. So if you could talk more about that experience, that would be great. Anyway, thanks, Rosie. Hope you have a good day. Bye.
Thanks, Jennifer from Long Island. I'm from Comac, exit 52. I wonder where you were, if you were ever at the flea market at the Long Island Arena, because I was there often buying all my school clothes. Listen, I'm in the middle of my experience with Guide Dogs of America. I was actually visiting someone who was in prison, and I saw the guide dogs. There was like a little tour, and I saw the guide dogs being trained by the prisoners, and I started to talk to them, and in the group was the man who is the president of Guide Dogs of America, a lovely man. And we talked for a while, and I told him that I had an autistic child. And he said, you know, that we provide dogs for autistic kids for free. And I was like, what? And they're trained to comfort the child, to apply deep pressure when the child is maybe out of control or spinning or stimming in a way that's dangerous for them. They work with children who elope, although my child does not elope, which is, you know, running away without understanding the danger. But they do so much for autistic kids. They do, obviously, for people who are blind. They do for people who suffer from PTSD, especially veterans. I'm not sure what the qualifications or the rules are for people who are looking to get one. I only know for autistic children. And it's a very long application process, as you would imagine. It's a long waiting period. We don't know yet if we've been approved. We're going to wait to find out. And, you know, they go by need. So every child has different needs, and every kid with autism is unique to themselves. And so we'll see. We hope that we get one, but even if we don't, we're going to continue to support the organization. And they also have emotional support dogs, which are not as highly trained, obviously, as the guide dogs. But Guide Dogs for America, look it up on Google. Good luck to you. I wish you all the best. And thanks for listening to me when you were in college. Fantastic. We got one more from Pennsylvania, I hear. Hit it.
Hey, Ro. This is Jen, 41, living in Pennsylvania. So listen, when I had just turned 11, my mom let my brother, my friend, and I go to see A League of Their Own at the discount movie theater in Philly called The Devon. I had been wanting to see it, but she was a single mom, so she was not trying to pay those regular movie prices. She drove us there, dropped us off, picked us up. It was the first time we were able to go to the movies completely by ourselves with no adult. We thought we were so cool. Fell in love with the movie. It was really empowering to me. As a young female, I felt very seen, couldn't really figure it out at the time, but I now know why. And also, I was a softball player, and it just made me feel like, yeah, of course, women and girls can do anything and everything. Why did it take a war for women to be able to play? But I got the movie on VHS and then on DVD, and I really do like know almost every word. Been a fan, obviously watched your show because I'm of that age. So my question for you is, my wife and I just purchased a home a few weeks ago, pretty exciting, and we officially move in a few days. We've been at the new house doing work to get it ready. So my question for you is, what do you like to do when you move into a new home to make it your own? What are your priorities? Is it your bedroom? I mean, obviously it would be right now, like Dakota's room, the kids' rooms, but is it your art space? And also, you got a lot of money, so people probably do all the things for you, but is there anything you like to do for yourself? Do you like to paint a room by yourself? I don't know, go out and buy some furniture, put it together. So yeah, what do you like to do to make a home your own? I appreciate you, Rosie. Thanks for being so open and authentically you.
Thank you, Jen 41 from Pennsylvania. That's very, very sweet. 11 years old, going to the movies by yourself. I remember that feeling completely and feeling like such a big kid, right? But what do I like to do in a home? I like to get it to smell good, number one. So I like other people's schmutz out of it. So whether that be sanding and not myself, always people to do this for me, sanding and staining the floors a different way, or putting in hardwood floors everywhere, or matching, make sure the wood matches in the house. And the smell is so vital, you know? I love candles that are really well made, and they smell like the fall, and they smell like you're in a safe and warm place. It's definitely the smell. I love really nice comforters and blankets. I now have a weighted blanket. Dakota, we got one for Dakota, and they did not like it at all. And so it was late at night in the bed, and I just pulled it over on me. And now I can't sleep without it. But I like nice blankets. And, you know, I like my house to be clean. My house as a kid, you know, motherless, it was not very clean. And I like it to be clean. I have people come over, go, how your whole life of having this many kids, can you have white furniture? And first time I ever went into somebody's house that was really rich was Madonna's in Florida, and she had all white furniture, and it was gorgeous. And I remember thinking, if I ever get rich one day, I'm going to have a house like this. So all of my taste in that, I think, comes from seeing a real live house like that looked like a magazine, and figuring out as I got older and more successful that I could, in fact, have that. And so I like to create that for my family, for my children, for myself. Thank you, Jen. And during my free time, I like to do art and craft. And so this wonderful room here where I do my podcast is also going to become the craft room. That's what I've decided. Hey, listen, if you want to leave a comment, send a voice memo, record it, and send it to onwardrosie@gmail.com. We look forward to your thoughts and questions and comments. And next week, join me with award-winning director, screenwriter, and groundbreaking filmmaker, Cheryl Dunier. Like many artists, Cheryl could not find within the existing framework anywhere that she was represented. So she made a new path that was so necessary, not only for herself, but for so many others. She's a groundbreaking independent filmmaker, and she's African-American, she's gay, she's smart, she's brilliant, and I love talking to her. So look for that. Till then, everyone, do your best. Keep your heart bubble wrapped, please. Onward, people. Onward.
Hey guys, you know what this playground could use? A wine country, huh?
A redwood forest would be cool.
Ski slopes!
Wait! Did we just invent California?
Discover why California is the ultimate playground at visitcalifornia.com.
Are you looking for the perfect move-in ready home this spring season? Now's the time to buy at Fisher Homes. For a limited time only, enjoy below market interest rates starting at 5.375% APR, 6.139% APR. With these exclusive lower rates, you can save hundreds on a move-in ready home and start enjoying the benefits of homeownership even faster. Schedule your personal tour with one of our new home specialists at fisherhomes.com and make this spring the season you find your perfect home sweet home. Financing provided by Victory Mortgage, LLC, NMLS 461249, Equal Housing Lender.
We went from normal life, healthy child to acute lymphoblastic leukemia or B-cell ALL. The St. Jude team came up to get CJ via ambulance. Shortly after that, I noticed a rainbow. It meant that there was hope. We were driving into hope. To have hope is to have your child healthy, and we have that because of St. Jude.
You can help kids fight childhood cancer. Please become a St. Jude Partner in Hope today by visiting musicgives.org.